Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza. And we are talking March's Reading Month, as we are duty-bound as librarians. And this month, we're talking Wild Animals, Wild Girls, and bite-sized reads as well.
Yeah. Hey, it is March's Reading Month, and being librarians, we are incredibly excited. We're celebrating by offering a March is a Reading Month scavenger hunt. Come on into any of our libraries. We're challenging children to read different types of books, such as maybe pick a book on animals, or read a book about a real person, a biography, or a graphic novel. You might be thinking, who is this for? Children 0 to 10. Yes, there are board books that are biographies for babies. So come on into our branches and celebrate with us. So I'm going to get us started with our books for this podcast. And I'm going to start with The Smallest Owl by Georgia Graham. Should I start the book part? So let's get us rolling with my first book, The Smallest Owlet by Georgia Graham. Oh my goodness, what a beautiful, beautiful book. It is a nonfiction book, and Georgia Graham is a Canadian illustrator and author, and wow, she is just outdone herself, I might even say, with this title. This is probably one of my favorites. The illustrations of a family of great horned owls is just beautiful. And this is actually a story that's, you know, based on a true story outside of her farm in Calgary. It's the story of how she witnessed one of the owlets falling out of its nest, and how the mama came down to take care of it, and the papa stayed up in the nest to take care of the other two. It kind of goes through several seasons. Just a beautiful, beautiful book. You learn a bit about, you know, that whole regurgitation process that owls do when they eat chunks of skunk or squirrel or whatever it is they do. I really, really enjoy this book. This would be what I might call not a story time book, per se, as much as like a family evening storybook. It's a little longer. It's a very gentle, quiet book, and just solid nonfiction for children.
It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it does. I can just see the pictures a little bit from here, and they look beautiful. Well, your book leads nicely into my next book, only in that the author, Miriam Darlington, of the book that I'm going to talk about today, her book that came out last year was called The Wise Hours, A Journey into the Wild and Secret World of Owls, and it was highly acclaimed. You saw it in a lot of different lists through the year. This is actually a 2024 release in the United States, but an older release in the UK where it was first published. The book I'm going to talk about now is called Otter Country, An Unexpected Adventure in the Natural World by Miriam Darlington. And when I think of otters, I think of, you know, our Potter Park Zoo otters are very beloved. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, otters are their favorite animals. There's something like very captivating about them. I've met a lot of people where they say, otter's my favorite.
Love otters.
Of course, otters have been in the news negatively a little bit in the last year for some otter attacks and that sort of thing. But Miriam Darlington was a devoted owl or otter lover, owls as well. But otters were her favorite animals. She was, you know, obsessed with owls. And when she was a child, she got to go to the Otter Trust, which was an organization trying to save otters, rather, in England. Boy, these two words are too close together for this for me today. She was otter obsessed and started the Otter News at her school. I mean, she was like an amateur, you know, science advocate, basically, a citizen scientist, I believe in the 70s. Otter hunting was banned in England. It was a big thing. They had otter hounds, which is now an endangered species of dog because there isn't otter hunting much anymore, especially not in England. It's not allowed. But what this book does is it takes the reader on a journey with Miriam Darlington, now as an adult, where she goes all across Britain. So if you love nature writing, you will love this book. This is some of the most exquisite, beautiful, lyrical nature writing you can read. If you also love Britain, if you love not just England, but the whole of Britain, she goes from Devon, where she lives, through Northumbria, Suffolk, and then she goes into Wales, Scotland. She ends the book back in Devon, but she does a little foray into Sussex. And she looks at the ecosystems, what they once were, how they've changed, and how that affects otters. And she's truly looking for otter sighting. Otters are extremely elusive, not as elusive as eels, when I talked about that book a while back, but they're very hard to see. And she does have some otter sightings, and they're beautiful. She's very present in those moments. This is a book that really slows you down. I think it's sort of completely anti sort of where our culture is going, a book like this, in the sense that if you zone out or if you speed read this one, you'll miss the whole point of the book. The point of the book is to be present, just like she was, you know, going through streams, muddy streams. She's got eels rubbing up against her. I mean, she's out in Scotland with midges. There's a lot of literature in this book. She goes to some of the classics like Tarka the Otter and Ring of Bright Water and goes to the places where those books were written. It's just an incredible book. So Otter Country by Miriam Darlington, not about owls, but she has another book about owls. I think I got it at the end.
Yeah, it was mostly otter. You're good. No, that one's been on my, ever since I saw the cover for that one pop up as an early announcement, that's been on my list. I haven't read it yet. I think I just got it, though.
Okay.
I think I just got it picked up.
It's got a great cover. Beautiful woodblock illustration.
Okay, so my book also sort of segues nicely in that I suspect this author is one of the wild girls that I'm going to talk about in my book. So, but it's kind of also the opposite. I want to talk about Wild Girls, How the Outdoors Shaped the Women Who Challenged a Nation by Tia Mills. Miles. We've actually talked about her on the podcast before for her book that
carried.
I always screw up the title of, All That She Carried, The Story of Ashley Sack, which is the part that I can remember. But she, this is the first of a series of a line of Norton shorts. So it's only about 180 pages. It's essays. And it's really looking at concisely, but beautifully, women who have been shaped by the outdoors and then have shaped the world around them very neatly. And it just really advocates for everyone of all ages, backgrounds, having access to outdoor spaces and the importance of outdoor spaces. But she goes from Harriet Tubman to Louisa May Alcott. She gives more context to people like Sacagawea and Pocahontas. But she also, you know, people that I hear even much less about, like the 1904 World's Fair team of indigenous basketball players that beat anybody they played, or the Anishinaabe poet and writer Jane Johnston Schoolcraft from the Sault Ste. Marie area, or even coming forward to activists such as Dolores Huerta and Detroit's Gracie Boggs. It's packed with stories about these women's lives and how they had the chance to be outdoors, and that really did shape their outlook and their views on the world. And so it's just a really interesting set of kind of mini biographies, but it's all has a really neat through line. And I will say it's a, I actually am not sure if I remember who read it, but it has a really, really wonderful audiobook version as well. So I strongly suggest Wild Girls. It's just a really, it's very interesting. And Miles also has a very big tie to, she used to teach at the University of Michigan. So there are a lot of Michigan-related stories that are part of this as well. So I
so good. That's been in my TBR for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, my next book is Jerry Changed the Game How Engineer Jerry Lawson Revolutionized Video Games Forever. It's written by Don Tate, and the illustrations are by Cherise Harris. And this was a book that I learned about through, it ended up on a list, best STEM books of 2024. That list is put out by the Children's Book Council. That's the nonprofit trade association for publishers, but also by the National Science Teaching Association. And they basically come up with a list of books that encourage STEM thinking. And they focused on the mind behind scientists or people who invent things. And that would be Jerry Lawson. You maybe have not heard of him. I had not. He is someone who grew up in New York and was always very interested in tinkering. He had asked for a special science kit as a gift from, you know, his parents, and instead he got a ham radio because it was a little cheaper for the family to get. And he just was very committed to finding ways to come up with new ideas, new ways to reach in communication. He is not the person, I would say, who invented the cartridge system for video games, but he was definitely a forerunner in that. He really developed the highway that led to that. He was also the first African-American who had his own video company or video game company. I really enjoyed just reading the timeline of how, video games are so popular, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got a big, big history. I really enjoyed this book and recommend it for families and teachers to take to the classroom.
That's awesome. See, that's the kind of nonfiction that video games were coming out probably when I was a kid. So, but anyway, that's the kind of nonfiction I felt like was not around. You know, just to hook in kids that, like, maybe they're reluctant readers even, possibly.
Right.
But they love video games. Here's a way to get them into thinking about the science behind it or the story. That is so cool. Very, very cool. My next book goes back to animals, and I have a goal when I talk about this book. I'm going to stick with the species and get it correct for the full annotation or the full book review of this one. But this book is called Gator Country, Deception, Danger in Alligators in the Everglades by Rebecca Renner. So when I was first reading about this book, I kept seeing articles about it, and I have not been able to find the article again when I was preparing for this podcast, but there was a quote in it that really stuck with me in one of the pieces. And the quote is by Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and it's, "The Everglades is a test. If we pass, we may get to keep the planet." And of course, this was written quite a while ago.
We're doing so hot. Sorry.
Yeah, right. And Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is famous for the tragedy that happened in the school with her name, but she was also an amazing environmental activist, and she, in particular, fought hard for the Everglades. She was an editor, or she was a journalist, she was a writer, but her passion was fighting for the Everglades when they were beginning to be developed very heavily, and she could see that it was destroying the ecosystems there. So that really ties into this book. And fascinatingly, this book is a little bit of true crime, which I can say as a nonfiction selector for the library system, that's a genre that's very popular, but I personally don't read very much. And I actually really liked it. It had a lot of plot for the kind of books that I like don't often have a lot of plot, but it was riveting. And what it is, it's something I didn't really know much about. It's about alligator poaching, and it's about wildlife investigators. You know, there's a whole bureau that does these undercover investigations to try to protect the environment. There's like wildlife justice, essentially. And it's about an investigator that goes undercover on a mission, Operation Alligator Thief, I think it's called, Operation Alligator. And he goes undercover. He has to assume a new identity. And he goes into right outside the Everglades and starts an alligator farm. And he goes from Jeff Babauta to Curtis Blackledge. And he assumes a 100% identity, a backstory, everything. And he's at the end of his career, and he's very experienced at undercover missions as a wildlife agent. But this one is particularly tough. The person before him failed the mission, and it's very dangerous. It's very intense, and he couldn't even know what it was. He had to sign on before he knew what it was. And he's extremely dedicated to his career. And he does it. He has to leave his family, he has to leave his wife, he has to leave his dogs, and he has to become this other person. So in this book, you get, it really is a true crime story, lots of suspense, lots of danger, but you get a story of the Everglades, beautiful nature writing of the importance of this ecosystem, but you also get a really personal story about Jeff, or Curtis, and about the poachers themselves. And he infiltrates in with them. He becomes friends with them. Some of them he's wary of, but a couple of them he really does get close to in the way that you can. You know, like when he goes to a bonfire, he doesn't really drink. He has all these things he does to make sure that he stays kind of in character.
Yeah,
but after a while, he starts to kind of feel for these people. A lot of them are doing it because they really need the money. But he also, at the end of the day, his commitment is to nature. It's to what has happened in Florida and trying to prevent ecosystem collapse further. Because what happens with alligator poaching is it creates a micro extinction in a small area. Alligators are really plentiful, and they are not endangered at all anymore. But they have micro extinctions in certain areas, and that throws off the ecosystem in that area. Mm-hmm. So it's really important. At the end of the day, he has to stay focused on that mission. So it's a story of the people. It's a story of alligator poaching in Florida, which is actually really fascinating. There are like kind of almost like pirates or Robin Hood. There's, you know, famous poachers that have legends after them. The author actually goes and spends time with some of the relatives of those people. So it's an environmental story. It's a true crime story. It's beautifully written. It's riveting. I cannot recommend this enough. I think it has sort of a broader audience than just nature writing. But at the heart of it, it's about water. It's so similar to the other book I talked about, Otter Country. It's about how diverting, damming, changing water, and how development have really endangered alligators. The other thing, it's about alligators. I have to say, alligators are so feared, and there's a little bit into the history of alligators. They were revered, they were deities at one point. Mm-hmm. Indigenous cultures revered them, and then with settlement into Florida, the narrative changed. They became a commodity. They became something to be feared and hated. And Jeff, on his alligator farm, they're peaceful for him. They're kind of like dogs. You know, he has no problem with his alligators at all, and he's raising them. So it might change your thoughts about alligators, regardless. You know, I don't know how you all feel as listeners about them, but you might feel differently after reading this book. So, excellent.
That's really neat. That's fascinating. Okay, I'm going totally off in a totally different direction, because I do that sometimes. I want to talk about The Floating Hotel, which is coming out this month by Grace Curtis. It's her second book. She writes kind of mashup, but primarily sci-fi so far. But her first one was a sci-fi western. This one features the Grand Abiona Hotel, which is a suborbital luxury resort. It is the home of a fascinating cast of characters, and one of them might be a political revolutionary hoping to destabilize the empire. Maybe. But we've got vacationers, we've got conference goers, we've got imperial spies. They're all converge on this resort. And it's a relatively, I mean, I would actually classify this as sort of cozy sci-fi, because it, in a way, each chapter is, I think every chapter, but I think most of the chapters are written from a different point of view. But the story, there's a through line about this particular voyage. But you get the background of some of the crew. You get the first story is actually how the current manager first ends up on the ship. He sort of stows away and gets adopted by the captain. And just grows up on the ship until the point where he inherits it from her. We've got a group of academics who regularly have their annual conference on the ship. And so you've got every stereotype of an academic, you know, the drunk academics, the people who are just there for the party. You've got people who are there who are very serious about their work. It's but it's just, and one of them is sort of a jaded woman who just really enjoys this trip. She's friends with this crew. She doesn't actually people particularly well, but she does like to show up at the Rose Art and drink. So it's great. You get her backstory. You get, so you just, it sort of expands, and you get some of it's people's backstories off the ship, along with a little bit of the ongoing storyline of the what's going on the ship. But it's, the stories interweave to build intrigue, and illustrate the connections between people. And it's just, at its core, it's a ragtag found family. And yes, a bit of a spy plot or espionage plot as well. There is quite possibly that radical at the center of all of this, and nobody knows who it is. So it's just a really well done, fun story that I would like people to go out and give it a try. So again, this is The Floating Hotel by Grace Curtis.
And I kept imagining on the water at first when you kept talking about it. Then I was like, floating
more
in space.
Interstellar. Yes, so it's going planet to planet, picking up people, dropping off people.
About the love boat in space and modern religion.
In a weird way, yes. It's sort of, in the sense that you get those different storylines of the people coming on and off, but you got that running story of the people on the love boat. Yes. That wasn't the jump I was making, but yes, it makes a certain amount of sense.
That's awesome.
Okay.
So last month, we asked our Facebook page followers, what's your favorite short story or short story collection? This was fascinating. This was fun to watch as people piled on with their answers. Lots and lots of love for Stephen King, actually. But also Shirley Jackson, Neil Gaiman. I have to say Neil Gaiman's has some of my favorite short stories out there. N.K. Jemisin. I love her short story collection. But also Exhalation by Ted Chiang. If you're not familiar with him, he's one of his short stories was the basis for the movie Arrival. It was kind of cool to see somebody jumped in with the YA young adult title, the multi-author collection Ancestor Approved, edited by Cynthia Latish Smith, which was also a Michigan Notable. And we also had a 2024 Michigan Notable winner, mentioning a few other Michigan Notable authors he's enjoyed, including Hassan Zenedin, who we've talked about on the podcast before, and Bonnie Jo Campbell. So I really enjoy these questions. It's very interesting to see what people are reading and enjoy.
Cool. All right, so I do have one last title. It is Call Me Iggy. It's by Jorge Aguirre and Rafael Rosado, who is the illustrator. It's a graphic novel, young adult graphic novel. Really interesting and beautiful story. It's about Iggy, or who is Ignacio Garcia, and he is Colombian-American. He was born and raised in Ohio. His parents are both Colombian. I want to say his father was an academic, perhaps at Ohio State. I don't know. But he is someone who really doesn't think much about his home culture or his parents' culture. He doesn't speak Spanish. He doesn't cook much. He doesn't dance. And a lot of people in his school are really surprised by this and make comments, you know, sometimes not so nice, sometimes meh, whatever. But this is a book that kind of explores a teenager getting in touch with his culture that he hasn't really embraced before. And the funny, I thought, well, one of the funniest aspects of this story was that he connects with his grandfather, who's actually dead. He goes down to the basement and he's looking around for something for his Spanish class because he wanted to take French, but he ended up in a Spanish class. He thought, okay, fine, I'll take the Spanish class. But he's looking for a flag and he finds an urn. And the urn falls over, and all the stuff in the urn comes out. Oh, it's, abuelito from Colombia. I'm not sure how his father came to own this, but he's got it. He's like, oh no. And the next thing you know, the ghost of Abuelito is there, giving him all sorts of zany advice, from love to Spanish to how to prepare arepas. I mean, it's just really funny. But you also learn a little bit about, you know, the hurt that might come from when you leave your home country and maybe you never come back. And this is what happened with Iggy's father and the grandfather. The grandfather had an orchid farm in Colombia, and he always thought that his son, who was Iggy's father, you know, didn't think maybe he didn't think this was good enough for him, or, you know, and just that hurt that exists for, you know, when you leave so abruptly and then don't ever come back to your home country. But this, it was just a really cool story because there are other characters in his high school experience, one of them being Marisol. She is a Mexican-American classmate of his who actually is undocumented. And you know a little bit, get to learn a little bit about her family's story and the work that they do at night. I would like to mention that this story is set actually in 2016, at the time when Hillary Clinton and President Trump, or Trump who went on to become president, were campaigning, and just the backdrop of that time and some of the conversations that were going on during those days in the United States, and, you know, what you heard on the campaign trail. It's a really interesting book. I recommend it. It's a very gentle, very young adult. I think most teens would like it.
That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, there's a little bit of a segue between your book, Mari, and my book that I'm going to talk about today. Because it is written by a person who considers himself a third culture kid. He grew up in South Korea, then he went to Singapore, then he went to Cambodia, then New York, then LA, and he moved about every 4 years. So there's sort of a tenuous connection to his Korean heritage through that movement, but a deep connection to it. The book is called Koreatown Dreaming, Stories and Portraits of Korean Immigrant Life. It's written by Emmanuel Han, and Emmanuel is a photographer, a photojournalist, a documentarian. He has a beautiful Instagram page of photography, and his work is focused on the intersection of culture and identity, stemming from his own experience. And he had a particular interest in Koreatown in Los Angeles, and he said that one of the reasons why Koreatown is so valuable and wonderful to him is he can get really good Korean food there. And it is a connecting point for a lot of Korean immigrants in cities who want that really good food. They want Korean-American food. They want, you know, to have that experience. And so during the pandemic, he was really charmed by Koreatown in LA. And during the pandemic, he became very worried about what was happening with these businesses. You know, they were not able to open. They're already being challenged by gentrification and other issues, and he was wondering if they're going to stay in business. So he started visiting slowly. And over time, this grew into a project. It had a Kickstarter campaign. This is actually the second iteration of the project into this fully-fledged book. But it was to go and take a photograph and do a photo essay, or an essay, rather, about a business owner in a Koreatown. And it started in L.A., but he actually branched out into other parts of the country in this final work here. And so he goes and takes these really beautiful pictures, and he goes, there's a huge section on restaurants, of course, but there are, there's a kimchi shop where they make kimchi from scratch. There is a music store that has K-pop, but all lots of other kinds of music, a bookstore, alteration shops, barber shops, hairstylists, an acupuncturist, a natural foods purveyor. One of my favorites was a music shop, and the man specialized in music for the elderly. He does music lessons and has these huge karaoke rooms specifically for elderly people to come to and enjoy music. So it is an absolute delightful book. I think this is like the best of nonfiction to me, these books that take something and amplify it and bring it to a larger audience. I mean, I don't think I haven't been to Koreatown in LA, and I felt like I was there, and I have so much appreciation. And it also tells the story of the Korean immigrant experience through a really nice foreword about the waves of Korean immigration, but also through each person's story. And you see a lot of multi-generational businesses or a lot of quite older business owners who are thinking about what's going to happen next. Am I going to give this to my family? Do they even want it? So there's a lot of, it really makes you think about maybe the businesses in your own community. Makes me think of, you know, Dearborn, and if you could go to many communities and do this type of book.
Right, right.
So just wonderful book.
Okay. So for my, I think the last book for today, vaguely related in its own way. But what I want to feature is The Kamigawa Food Detectives by Hisashi Kashiwai. This is, if anybody, and I know they have because I keep an eye on the stats and the book's checking out, but if anybody out there liked the book Before the Coffee Gets Cold, or the series of books after the book Before the Coffee Gets Cold, this is a book for you. It is written in that same style, I feel like. This is sort of, have you ever had a dish or a meal that just sort of sticks in your memories, and you try to recreate it, or you try to find it other places, but it's just not quite right? This is the Kamigawa Food Detectives is a father-daughter team that specialize in these types of cases. And so they run a truly nondescript diner in Kyoto, and then have advertised in such a way that they don't give the address. They advertise in a culinary magazine, they don't give the address, and the editor is not allowed, or the editor generally does not give out the address to people. Every once in a while she caves, but in general, the editor does not give out the address. So people who find them really want their help. And it's just sort of, it's a book of short stories or cases where they have people come to them for varying reasons. Maybe it's a childhood memory, maybe it's a memory around a traumatic event. Maybe there's just varying reasons that people want to track down those memories or those dishes. But they ask a lot of questions. They do, the father is a former police detective actually, and does research, and he will track down and recreate these dishes, and even go so far in some cases to say, okay, here's what you need to do it. I've put together the special ingredients and the tools you need to make this work the way you want it to. But it's always just the center point of life-changing memories for people. Wow. It's a quick read. It was just fascinating. It really made me think about what those foods might be for me, yeah. What those meals might be. I was born and raised in Lansing, and I think of some of those closed restaurants that... Yeah. We'll show up on foodies pages and Lansing Facts and things like that. Places that I remember having a really good meal. But but when you think about it, it's a really good meal, both because of the food, but because of whatever is going on around you. And that's sort of kind of the emphasis of this. It's a first book. It's an international bestseller. It was translated for Britain last year, so it came out in October in the UK, Japanese originally. And then a sequel will be coming out into the United States in the fall, and I'm really looking forward to it. I really just thought it was a lovely set of stories. Also, I am also one of those people that likes like the manga What Did You Eat Today, or those types of just sort of stories around food. I find fascinating regardless, so I think people should give a try. But that's especially really if you like Before the Coffee Gets Cold.
It's so brilliant and universal.
Yes, exactly.
I think everybody, I mean, you shouldn't say that because maybe somebody wouldn't, but I think almost everybody has something like that. where it's that
memory. The more I think about it, the more it's like I can think of a few different things I would like to, and even have tried, you know.
Right.
But what would I do? How do I track that down?
We have a memory of a cake in our family called the Kuchen. It was something, it was like my grandmother had it, and we'd go up to the UP, and it was from one of her friends, and we all remember it a little bit slightly differently, and we keep trying to find it. So we need them. Too bad it's not real.
Yeah.
Like for anybody who might be listening from my high school class, it's the pink cookies. Everybody's looking for the sugar cookie recipe from the Lansing School District when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And that comes up repeats in conversation.
Yeah. That's awesome. As I was listening to you, I was like, well, what kind of memories from my past? And like, I'm thinking of like, anyone from the Detroit area might remember or know of this restaurant, which I'm pretty sure is still open, Xochimilco. They just had this amazing recipe for a botana, which I'm Mexican, but this Mexican restaurant, I'd never heard of that, a botana, okay. It's sort of like an appetizer of some kind, sort of like nachos, but slightly different. Mm. And oh my goodness, just the blends of the spices and the cheese, and I'm like, that came to my mind, and even their, like how they prepare burritos or enchiladas. Yeah. I'm like, whoa, those, I remember those. I'm not sure they would still taste that way if I went there today.
It is a funny thing.
These memories I have from high school.
And, and a little bit of the story is the setting of the scene, too. It's sort of like, basically, they interview, they tell them to go away for a fortnight, come back, we'll be ready. And it's sort of, you know, it is a little bit of a setting the scene to before bringing out the food.
Yeah.
Sort of, it's so and, cool. And an explanation of how they track down the information, you know, track down the story.
Wow.
So it's, it's, and again, it's not a long book. They're short, short stories. With a through line, you'll see the picture, cover picture is a cat, and it's, there's a through line with Spooky showing up in every story. But it's just a, it's fascinating, and it was thought-provoking for me, as we can see here.
Yeah.
All right, that was our last title for today. Everybody, go forth, read more, and enjoy your book journey.
Yes, read more. It's March.